Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. The show is now entering its fifth year. This is the fifth year of Connect the Dots, and it's so exciting to be with you once again for the next year of talking about the connection between our personal health and the total health environment. Everything that we are exposed to, depend on for life supports, do in our world, encounter in our world, how it affects our health on individual, community, societal, and global levels. That's our topic here. And I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, exploring these topics here on the radio program as well as in the Huffington Post, Alternet, EcoWatch, and other online media. On today's show, we're going to be focusing on something that's particularly appropriate to the beginning of a new year and the post-holiday season. And, you know, right after we're coming through a time when everyone was kind of both turning a new leaf, turning a corner, indulging in holiday celebrations, it's both a really perfect time to kind of think a little bit about what's going on in our bodies, and some people are thinking about it a lot because of how they ate and consumed, et cetera, over the holidays. And it's also the time when the publishing world traditionally helps people think about how to turn over a new leaf by looking at how they can support their health. And the book we're going to be talking about today with the author with whom we're going to be speaking is focusing on that. I don't know that we've had a couple of shows in the past where we've talked about the widespread problem of digestive distress and what's going on in our body and how it affects us when our gut is unhappy and we can't digest our foods properly and all the, you know, a whole host of health issues that you'll learn about today go along with that. My guest today is Vincent Pedre, MD. He's the author of Happy Gut, the cleansing program to help you lose weight, gain energy, and eliminate pain. The book is hot off the press, and it's an easy-to-follow, actionable guide that will help you, if you suffer from chronic stomach pain, heal your irritated intestines and all the symptoms that go along with that. And Dr. Pedre is someone whom I know personally and have known for many years, and he came to focusing on this particular area because he himself had experienced gut problems and sought approaches through his medical practice and medical studies and figured out how to heal his own body. And it's that experience that he's bringing to his book and to today's show. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Dr. Vincent Pedre.
Hi, glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Now, first of all, let's back up. You know, how many Americans are actually having gut problems? I mean, is it just a couple of people on the side, or because it almost seems like it's become extremely common and hardly any of us know, you know, I mean, most of us would know people who are having this complaint. How common is it actually?
Yeah, I would say the estimates are 1 in 5 Americans, which is approximately 70 million, suffer from gut issues in general. And about 10 to 15% of Americans are estimated to have irritable bowel syndrome.
That's a big
characterized,
deal.
Yeah. It's pretty widespread. And I would say from my experience taking care of patients that even when people don't think they have gut issues, there may be gut issues in the background of other diseases that they may present with as well. So I think the gut is, of course, of primal importance in health, and not just with people who have apparent gut issues like bloating, indigestion, diarrhea, constipation, gut distress, but it can also be in the background of people that are suffering from allergies, from asthma, from fatigue, from mental fog, even from migraine headaches. So the ramifications of having imbalanced gut health can be felt throughout the body.
And yet it's kind of considered a sort of embarrassing topic. You know, it's not like people are hesitant to talk about it. They're embarrassed if they have to bring it up. I have a personal family friend who spent years going from doctor to doctor to doctor, trying to get treatment for this, trying all kinds of different approaches, receiving all kinds of different interpretations about what the problem, the origin of the problem could be. And I know that because of my own background as a health reporter, reporting on health, writing books, I'm also a trained health coach, you know, family members were you know, please talk to Allison, and I was happy to speak with him, but it was almost so embarrassing. He was, like, ashamed of this, and he was getting so much conflicting information about it. Tell me, is there a big kind of wall between how this would be treated in conventional medicine and how it would be treated in integrative or functional medicine? And has there been a change or a development in understanding gut problems in recent times?
Well, first I'll address the difference between the Western medical approach, which is my background and the way I was first trained to practice medicine, and the integrative functional medicine approach, which is what I've dedicated the last 10 years of my practice learning and, you know, working to become an expert in a field that is rapidly growing and evolving very quickly. So the Western model tends to look at disease as a classification. And from that classification of, say, a conglomeration of symptoms, then there is a treatment for that. And typically the treatment, because Western or allopathic medicine, as it's also referred to, is so connected to the pharmaceutical industry that the treatment is going to be some sort of medication. So if you're constipated, you're going to get certain types of laxatives. There have been medications over the years that have come on and off the market. An example was Zelnorm for irritable bowel syndrome. And then they found that it had some potential cardiac side effects. And I think in the wake of the Vioxx scandal, the FDA moved very quickly to take Zelnorm off the market. There are other medications that are used for constipation, even things like old antidepressants known as tricyclic antidepressants that are prescribed for patients that have irritable bowel syndrome. The problem is that you're identifying symptoms and treating them almost like putting a Band-Aid on them without really going under the surface to look at, okay, what is going on in this person's gut? And that is the approach that functional medicine takes, is let's look at the root cause. So we want to go under the surface and look at, okay, well, let's use an example. Here we have two patients presenting with bloating and indigestion and lots of discomfort. One of them maybe has a little more mental fog. The other one just has a lot of bloating, especially immediately after meals. The second patient, the bloating comes about an hour after they eat, and it's very uncomfortable. Both of them would describe it as feeling like they're pregnant. Now, very similar symptoms, but in one case, when using the functional medicine approach, you're going to discern, well, what is the underlying cause here? So is this person, do they have lactose intolerance and they're eating too much dairy and that's causing a lot of gassiness? Or does one of them have something called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? And that's caused by a whole slew of things. It could be they were on antibiotics. It could be that they're eating a diet that's too high in sugars and refined carbohydrates. Now, very similar, the second person.
Now, I just want to interrupt you for a second here.
Sure.
And mention, you know, I just want to contrast the way we're talking about getting to, you know, an underlying and distinct cause for the symptoms. Versus, like you were saying, that instead, you know, in a conventional approach, they might be given an antidepressant. I mean, that is going to have a lot of other effects on the person. It's going to change their mood. It's going to change their brain function. It's something there is now recent research that it could permanently change, you know, brain function. You know, it has long-lasting neurological effects, not just short-term ones. So, you know, that's not something. There is research that shows that for certain populations, antidepressants are a potential way to go. You know, for very severe depression. But here, you know, the person isn't even in the case that you described. They're not even depressed. They're just being treated with a depressant to deal with a gut issue. Maybe they are depressed.
They might be. And, for example, in the second case that I was talking about, let's say it's a yeast overgrowth or a candida overgrowth. It could be a non-candida yeast. But yeast produces a lot of toxins, and these toxins get absorbed, and they affect your brain as well, and we're learning how important that gut-brain connection is, that actually the microbes in our gut produce a lot of neurotransmitters that get absorbed, and they can cross the blood-brain barrier. So there's a connection there, and like you said, we're looking for the underlying cause. And the other thing is that we're approaching the person as a system. So I like to use the analogy of a symphony orchestra, and a person's body is like the symphony. And say if the violins are out of tune and the drums are coming too late in the beat and the saxophones are on a different key, then the whole symphony is not going to work right. So what functional medicine is trying to do is to go in and figure out where are the imbalances and what can we balance to allow your body, this symphony, to regain harmony once more. And that's a process that happens not just during a singular interaction with a doctor, which is very typical Western medicine. You go in, you have a cold, say they think it's a bacterial infection, here's an antibiotic, goodbye, I don't see you again. But in the functional approach, we understand that people's situations, because we're dealing with a system, can change over time. So if I'm giving someone an antibiotic, you know, because sometimes you have no other recourse with someone, maybe they do have a true bacterial infection and you have to give them an antibiotic, then I'm also going in and talking to them about reestablishing their microbial gut population after they've been on the antibiotics, possibly with probiotics, protecting the gut, also working on the diet. So diet is a very big component of what we do with functional medicine, you know, because it goes all the way back to the age of Hippocrates that we believe food be thy medicine. And that should be, you know, your first medicine cabinet is in your kitchen. It's what you eat. It's what you put in your mouth.
How many people do you think are looking at food that way? I mean, I certainly know that there's a certain segment of the population that looks at food that way, but I mean, in terms of overall, how common, you know, I mean, obviously I've been involved for 25 years in putting that word out to people. But how far do you think that understanding about the role of food for health has penetrated the population in terms of where we are now?
I think that probably the biggest game changer with that is the rise of the internet and the free flow of information. And, you know, and I say that kind of, you know, sometimes as a doctor, you sort of dread when somebody says, well, I was Googling something or I was researching on the internet, because you also know there's a lot of disinformation out there. But at the same time, I think we have to give the internet props for also having allowed this massive free flow of information where you can go and investigate and hear about other people's stories. And a lot of what is out there is how people have healed themselves by changing their diet when Western medicine said you had to go on these toxic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely think that we are on, I think we're in the midst of an awakening.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give you a percentage. I don't know how many people, but just from seeing what's happening and even the types of books that are coming out, that are very food focused, but also on how you can heal, like the autoimmune paleo diet, and hearing stories of how people have reversed their autoimmune condition using diet, I think are pretty amazing. And it's definitely, you know, we've entered an era where we're no longer subject to just what the Western doctor told you was the truth, was the dogma, which was unfortunately for many, many years dictated, whether they realized it or not, by the pharmaceutical industry, because everything was so tied together. The money and research was coming from the pharmaceutical industry, and medicine was designed to train doctors to prescribe drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in a shift right now. I think we're in a major, I think we're in awakening, and it's going to take years. But I think that the ball is in motion, and it's finally going in the right direction.
How does diet affect, you know, like what kind of diet should people with gut issues be looking at? And are there misconceptions about what kind of diet someone should eat if their gut is bothering them?
Well, I will say that from my experience, sometimes it can be as simple as finding the one food that you're eating too much of that is the source of your gut distress. And for some people, this could be dairy, for example. Dairy is a very antigenic substance. A lot of the dairy out there has been treated with bovine growth hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that it doesn't always have to be labeled. And so it's very difficult to know unless you're buying organic dairy or unless you're buying dairy directly from the farm and you know how they raise their cattle. It's not always easy to know what's in that dairy. But it's also a very difficult protein for us to digest. But gluten is also become quite a huge problem. We know that about 2% of the population has celiac disease, but we estimate that approximately 10% of the population has some level of gluten sensitivity that is not quite celiac, but it's also not normal. And whether you have celiac disease or the more controversial, because there is a bit of controversy about what they call non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and I have patients like that, you take them off of gluten and they do really well and they feel better. They may feel more awake, less mentally foggy. They don't get constipated like they used to. Now, unlike a celiac patient, they probably can tolerate little bits of gluten here and there, whereas if you are an extreme celiac patient, even a small dose of gluten contaminating food that you're eating can really make you sick. And I have patients that are like that as well.
Let me delve into this a little bit, because one of the things that happens around, you know, these kinds of health discussions is that there's a certain group of people who have kind of already adjusted their thinking or had personal experiences or know people who've had personal experiences for whom, you know, most of what you're saying, the assumptions behind it will just, you know, make perfect sense, and they're ready to go there with you, and they're kind of excited and happy and are like, well, this is the next program that's going to help this specific problem. If I have it, I'm really glad that something's come along. You know, that's just terrific. Then there'll be other people who are kind of going, oh, you know, my girlfriend has, you know, now it's the gluten they're allergic to, and they're all of these gluten products, and gosh, you know, it's just a way for another company to make money selling us a more expensive bread, and, you know, most people don't need that, but they read about it, and they get sold this, and then I don't believe this, but I know people, you know, there are many people who think this, you know, and it's just a way to make money, and, you know, they're not taking my money, and I don't need this. So it's what you're saying is that in your practice, you know, you have seen people who maybe were not, you know, registering on available tests, or maybe there aren't good available tests, as really having celiac disease, and nevertheless, who exactly had a response.
Who benefit. But the thing is that, you know, in New York State, we can't, where my practice is, we can't do all tests. But there
is
a lab. It has to do with licensing. The New York State has its own laboratory licensing body that's separate from CLIA, which is the federal program that licenses labs. And New York State believes that their licensing criteria are, let's say, more stringent than CLIA. So whereas pretty much every other state in the country accepts CLIA's determination whether a lab is valid or not or can be run, New York State has an extra step. You have to go through the New York Education Department licensing body for labs. So it makes it, and this is my, you know, I don't have a full understanding of the politics behind this, but I've spoken to a number of laboratories, and I also understand there are very high fees that they have to pay in order to be able to run tests in New York State. So sometimes I think as a business matter, because New York State puts that very giant gate that they have to go through, that some labs decide not to offer their tests in New York State. But I still learn of these lab companies, and there's one that can test for not just gliadin antibodies, but antibodies to about a dozen different gluten metabolites. And this could be why a person who's not showing up with the typical celiac antibodies may have antibodies to another gluten fraction, and that's why they're gluten sensitive. But I see it in my patients. So I have patients that I've told, and I've had them very stable on a gluten-free diet, maybe also combined with dairy-free, for example, sometimes also corn-free. And they might go see another doctor, a regular gastroenterologist, and they inject confusion into the picture, and they'll tell them, you know, your gut issues have nothing to do with your diet. I had one patient that was told that, and she was going on vacation and just decided to go on a gluten rampage and had all the wheat and bread she wanted. And she got so sick, so sick. She was sick for about 1 to 2 weeks from that, and she came back and talked to me. And you know, not everything is lost. We put her back on the program. And to me, experiential learning is probably one of the most powerful tools. And that's happened with a number of patients. And I think, well, you know, you have to really, a lot of what we do in functional medicine is kind of honoring and listening to our bodies. And part of what I help patients do is honor and listen to their body. And I serve as the guide to just make them aware of the communication that their body is giving them.
Mm-hmm.
And I
mm-hmm.
think that communication to me is more powerful than any blood test we can do, because we can't possibly test for every single way that a food may react with the immune system in the body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's
well,
it's
I
not possible.
Agree with you about that, but I know also that there are many people who won't come in the door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there are some who will, and then there are many who won't. And not only that, but the many who won't can do things like, if they think it's all nonsense, they can support the kind of policy laws that you're mentioning in New York State, and as a longtime New York State resident, I certainly know what you're talking about, that prevent New York State residents from getting the kind of the very validation or verification that they would want to feel, some of them, to feel confident, you know, that
and
these
also
things are bona fide. So it's important what not only the patients who get it think, but also what people who don't get it think, because they will influence the laws. And it's very hard for people in New York to get all kinds of different tests, you know, both for gluten and for a whole host of other things that could really be useful and indeed, you know, life-changing, and because of these policies. I'm really glad you're highlighting that too, because
I'm gonna also mm-hmm. I want to mention something, because
mm-hmm.
We cannot ignore this fact
mm-hmm.
that autism has gone from 1 in 2,000 children to now 1 in 50 boys,
mm-hmm.
and this has happened in one lifetime. You cannot attribute that solely to a genetic shift. That's not just genetics. And we have to look at our changing food supply, the toxins that we're getting exposed to. I mean, we know that, for example, I'll go back to wheat. We know that for convenience, wheat plant is sprayed with Roundup, which has glyphosate. It's a pesticide.
Is that part of the problem with wheat, really?
That to me, I was looking for reasons like, how is it possible in one generation the autism rates go up by, you know, 500%.
Mm-hmm.
And there's got to be a reason for that. And why am I seeing so many patients now, more than what I saw when I first started practicing, with
mm-hmm.
gut issues and problems with wheat? And if you spray the wheat plant, so wheat is not a GMO crop, but they use glyphosate because it desiccates it, so then it's
mm-hmm.
easy, that way it matures all at the same time. So the
mm-hmm.
wheat that we're getting is going to have some glyphosate residues. And there was a
mm-hmm.
study done on fish where they looked at the effect of wheat gluten with glyphosate on the lining of their digestive system. And they found that it actually pokes small holes in the digestive lining. So, in other words, it causes what we call leaky gut syndrome, quote unquote.
Oh my!
And
that is very serious.
Yeah. Yeah, because then
you are a gut expert, and you're saying that this commonly used agricultural product pokes holes in the digestive tract.
Yes. I mean, we're talking about microscopic, but when you increase the leakiness of the gut, so obviously our gut has to be leaky to a certain extent, because we need to be able to absorb nutrients, but you don't want excessive leakiness so that then you're absorbing partially digested proteins, maybe some bacteria, yeast that are on the other side of the gut barrier getting into the wall in between the cells or the interstitial space, and that's where our immune system is. So 80% of our immune system is along the gut lining. So once
this
you're
is
causing...
very, this is a very important finding, because if something like this is going on, then this will result in increasing allergies, increasing autoimmunity, increasing disorders of all types. Are allergies, in fact, known to be on the rise? As this has been, you know, kind of running rampant in the food supply.
Yeah, and we know that things like asthma rates have been going up. Obviously, there's two factors with that. There's diet, which is the often overlooked factor, and then there's, of course, the environmental, the polyaromatic hydrocarbons, the air pollution, smog, ozone, ground-level ozone, so all that aggravates things, but it's the setting with which the person is facing this, and that setting is created by what's happening in your gut, because 80% of your immune system is right there along the lining of your gut. So if you turn on the immune system, I kind of equate it to the U.S. terror alert. Like, you could be in a green, an orange, or yellow, or red alert. Mm-hmm. If your gut immune system is on red alert, it's going to put your immune system all over your body on red alert, and that also means the immune cells that are lining the airways. So then you become reactive to environmental, it could be pollen, it could be dust, but you become more reactive. So I've seen patients where by healing their guts, you take away their spring allergies. And honestly, the first time I saw this, I was amazed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this is completely antithetical to what I was taught in Western medicine. But when I saw it happen over and over, I knew, okay, in the background, the setting is created by the gut. And yes, you can have, I grew up with spring allergies. And like you said in the beginning, I had gut issues, irritable bowel syndrome growing up. And as I healed my gut, I really don't even, I mean, now patients will come in and tell me it's a horrible allergy season. And I don't even know.
That's a big change, and that also, I mean, I can see why you were drawn to go into this by virtue of that experience. Yeah, that's amazing. And have allergies, like, say, over the last 10 years, I mean, have they been known to increase? Are they increasing, in fact? In other words, what you're describing here is a rampant cause, but it would also follow that if this is now, you know, kind of permeating the society and the agriculture, that there would be more of the conditions caused by leaky gut, such as allergies and others. In other words, and yet each person getting it is sort of treating it on their own, and obviously they have to deal with it on their own, but they regard it as their own special problem. Oh, you're allergic, you know.
I mean, I know that in my neighborhood of Manhattan, which is, I'm very close to East Harlem, that asthma rates in East Harlem have been going up. And we also have to think about, you know, this, our relationship with germs when we talk about that. You know, are we being too clean? So we know that children that are born and raised in farms tend to have less allergies than children born in the city, and not allowed to play in the dirt and always being clean and using antibacterial hand lotions and soaps, because we do need a little bit of dirty in our lives to be healthy.
So actually, in your work with healing the gut, all of what we've been discussing today in the program is really in your realm. So it may just sound like I'm experiencing gut discomfort, or I don't digest my food so well, or I have one or more of the symptoms you mentioned, but actually it travels out from there to possibly impact a wide variety of different potential health problems that show up.
Yeah, I like to think
aren't showing up in the gut, you know.
Yeah, I like calling the gut the seat of all health. Because I think up to now, it's not a very sexy organ system to talk about, but it's been silently in the background all these years. You just have to think that if you're not digesting your food properly, if you're not absorbing nutrients properly, nothing else is going to work, and you're not going to feel well. So, and even when working with patients that have other chronic health issues, in in the work that I do, you always have to make sure that the digestive system is functioning well and healing, even, say, a patient who is toxic. Let's say, for example, a patient who has heavy metals, which I also see in my practice. You have to make sure that they're pooping. If they're constipated and they're toxic, they're not getting rid of their toxins.
Will they tend to be constipated with that kind of a toxic overload?
A lot of times.
Is that like another common thing? If someone has heavy metals, will they tend to be constipated?
You'll see these things together, but it's not necessarily the case. For example, a lot of women that are going through menopause now who are maybe starting to break down some bone. And during their child years, they were exposed to leaded paint and leaded gasoline, which was used before the mid-1970s. And the way the body protects itself from lead is to pocket it in the bone. So if you're slowly absorbing it over the years, then as a woman goes into menopause, the bone starts breaking down. They start releasing the lead back into the system. And that can cause a whole slew of symptoms. And there's many aspects to detoxification that have to do with the gut or gut-related organs like the liver and the gallbladder. But certainly people who are not having regular bowel movements are going to tend to be more toxic.
That makes complete sense. What would be your, you know, just a simple overview of the most basic kind of program that you recommend for people? I realize that, you know, if you're constipated or if you're having diarrhea, you're not going to be getting the same treatment necessarily. But you know, what would be your most common takeaway recommendations?
Well, I mean, basically the program I put together for Happy Gut, which was designed to be able to help the broadest group of people with gut issues. We're taking out for 28 days, so we're doing a 28-day cleanse. And the reason for that is that it really takes 2 weeks. If you're eating a diet that's very high in a lot of these foods, and kind of I call them like the toxic foods that are causing inflammation for your gut and your body, it takes 2 weeks for your body to heal. The first week on a cleanse like this, you may get headaches, you may feel really tired, you're going to get a lot of detoxification symptoms. It takes about 2 weeks to calm the immune system down from these types of high-sensitivity foods, which I'll mention now are wheat, gluten, dairy, soy, corn, and legumes. And then sugar
legumes
is in there.
Legumes are high-sensitive? Hello.
Well,
wait a minute here. Legumes are high-sensitivity.
I know. We normally think of legumes as healthy. But legumes have two things that can really trigger the immune system. They have lectins and they have phytic acid. Lectins tend to activate the immune response, and they can also, because they're short carbohydrate chains, they can basically be transferred to tissues in the body and then make those tissues antigenic. So there's a theory that lectins may be involved in the autoimmune response.
Wow.
And phytic acid is an anti-nutrient that chelates minerals, so it'll prevent you from absorbing certain minerals, say like trace elements like zinc, selenium, magnesium. So they can deplete your body of minerals. And then, of course, alcohol and coffee because of the strain that it puts on the liver. So because it's a cleanse and we're trying to kind of, basically what I tell my patients is we're trying to create a blank slate. And on that blank slate, then we discover what is the best diet for you.
Well, I just have to comment that 2 weeks to clean out your gut, I mean, that's a bargain. That's a bargain. That's a really, abbreviated time period. I mean, that's amazing.
then so the first 2 weeks, that's what you're doing. And the third week is really just fortifying the changes. And the reason I did 28 days is because I really feel that you need that extra week to really solidify what you've done. And they also say it takes 4 weeks, maybe 4 to 6 weeks, but at least 4 weeks to establish new eating habits and new lifestyle habits. And because my program is founded on a systems approach to the body, it's not just about diet. You know, we were talking a little bit about this before we came on. It's about cleansing your kitchen of the toxic substances that you might be ingesting from your cookware or your cooking utensils. It's about making sure that you're drinking clean water. It's also about cleansing your mind of negative thoughts and filling it with gratitude. So I believe that all of these aspects are important, and it's not just here saying, okay, change your diet, but don't worry about changing any other aspects of your life. I think you have to do everything together, and the digestive system, the gut, being kind of a very sensitive, in some ways, sensory organ. You know, so when you're nervous, you'll feel it in your gut. If you're doing something that is ethically feels wrong to you, you might feel nauseous. You might want to vomit. So the gut is this very sensitive organ, and what makes it feel better is a balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic being the overdrive that would get you to run if you had a dinosaur chasing you, and the parasympathetic is the one that relaxes you. And digestion is a parasympathetic activity. So in order to have a healthy gut, you have to address all of these aspects together.
I have a question about that. I think that's I think understanding, like the neurology as you're just describing it, and where, you know, the kind of function that the gut is doing, and the kind of, you know, I mean, what immediately comes to mind for me that you're describing, what it brings up is why it wouldn't be best to, you know, eat while on the run. Or, you know, or eat at your desk while you're frantically meeting a deadline. Or, you know, in other words, what you're saying is that actually as you digest, you have to be in a more parasympathetic mode. A lot of the various kinds of self-help books counsel people to find ways to get into a parasympathetic mode. Relaxation, stress management, guided imagery, yoga, resting, you know, a host of other things that are used for that purpose. And one of the reasons that that's so prevalent as advice in our time is that the thrust of all of the societal pressures is all about doing the opposite and being on the sympathetic side, running, achieving, doing, striving, making it happen, overriding what's in the way, blah, blah, blah. So if you're, unless you're maybe, you know, caring for an infant at home, or you're a horticulturist or something, if you're exposed to certain kinds of work fields, you know, then there's, or businesses, you know, then there's always the possibility that there's this kind of pressure being exerted, you know, or governing that environment. And so if we lived in a very different placid society, maybe we'd be telling people how to kind of rev up a bit. But what you're pointing out is, it seems to me, is that it's particularly not a good idea to be in the revved up mode when you're eating. Is that true?
Absolutely. Like I said, that digestion is a parasympathetic activity. And there's a reason that, you know, historically people ate in community. And we still have these traditions like Thanksgiving, like the holidays, like Shabbat, where people sit down at the table and slow down and talk, and all of that, that stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, as long as there's not an argument going on. Let's just assume it's a, you know, it's a friendly interaction. That's how we're meant to eat, and we're living in a time when everything is so rushed. Like you said, people are eating at their desks. People are eating on the run. They don't slow down, and that can be an often overlooked reason for why they might be suffering from some gut distress. So it may not only be the diet, it may be the lack of slowing down to actually allow their bodies to digest their nutrients.
Mm-hmm. So the very helpful thing that anyone can do is they can just, you know, make it possible in some way to, if they can, to slow down when they're eating. That gives the gut a start. What about this habit that I know that coffee is not on the, you know, the 28-day program you offer in your book, The Happy Gut, right? I mean, you're not going, you know, yay, hooray for coffee. But what about the practice of finishing a meal with coffee? You've just eaten. Does that kind of, is there some, it's such a traditional practice, you know, in so many societies. I mean, it may have had a different effect than in places where, or like our society, where people are consuming, you know, cups and cups of coffee all the time. Why do you think that is? That and how does that function to, at the very end of the meal, go to the coffee?
And it may have to do, you know, what I was going to say is that it depends on the society. So if you're in England, you might be finishing with a cup of tea. Or maybe just the, you know, or if you're in India, maybe it's the warm herbal tea. So I think that it helps kind of move and stimulate the digestion. We know that coffee can have a laxative effect.
That's right. That's
so it helps
it.
Push the food down. But for me, for someone who's happens to be what I call slow metabolizer, so I don't clear coffee metabolites very easily.
Right.
A coffee after the meal would rev me up too much.
Yep.
So it wouldn't be good.
No, I get that. I'm the same. I mean, I'm actually 99% a tea drinker, and if I were to, which is only something I would do very rarely, eat out with friends for dinner and have a steak, you know, I would have, on that occasion, I might have a cup of decaf or something to kind of rev up the digestion of, you know, a fairly heavy food. Otherwise, unless I was just, you know, on a deadline and kind of had to resort to coffee, I would pretty much avoid it. But I, because I'm a slow metabolizer too. I, you know, if I drink it past a certain hour, forget it. So I will stay up. It's unfortunate because fast metabolizers have a lot of, you know, good health benefits from being fast metabolizers. But there you have it. But in general. But I was wondering, so it may even be that genetically in cultures where, like the French, you know, where they eat these enormous meals and the coffee always comes, or the Italians, and the coffee comes at the end, it may be that they're all, you know, there's a predominance, let's say, of fast metabolizers who can handle that. And then it does have a digestive benefit. But if you are not in that group, and, you know, then it wouldn't have the benefit, it would have an adverse effect on you. Even
and
if it is a custom,
I'm gonna think that it probably also evolved. I know in Cuban culture, it's very common. My mom could drink coffee at midnight and then go straight to bed, and so she was a fast metabolizer. But you know, I know in Cuban culture, the meals were typically very carb heavy. So a meal like that is going to want to put you to sleep. And usually right after the meal, they have an espresso. So I think it might have also evolved to counter the effect of the very rich meal, and it's going to make you want to take a nap. And so you can wake up again So you're taking yourself out of the parasympathetic back into the sympathetic.
That makes actually total sense. And I personally would be very unlikely to consume a large carb meal in the evening. So, but I see exactly what you're talking about. Let me give another plug to the book so that you listeners know what we're talking about. We're talking about Happy Gut, the cleansing program to help you lose weight, gain energy, and eliminate pain with our wonderful guest today, my friend, Dr. Vincent Pedri, MD. Let's just chat a bit in the last 5 minutes of this show just to kind of bring in another flavor here. You know, Dr. Pedri and I actually initially connected around, and this won't surprise my long-term listeners, around the topic of toxic exposures, because we both had been in New York City at the time of 9/11, when a lot of toxins were released into the winds and airstreams of the city in the wake of the horrible, horrible explosion and everything that followed. And in addition, we also connected around move by industry to threaten New York City's water supply through fracking upstate in regions near the water aquifers, which supply New York City water. So Dr. Pedri was and remains, in my eyes, a very unusual bridge person from the medical profession in really looking at the bigger picture in terms of, what toxins and some of these larger events in our society are doing to our health. So I know in your book, Happy Gut, that, you talk about toxic products at home, the importance of drinking healthy water. I wonder if you could just give a little bit more of your view of the role of toxins in gut health.
I think it's not just about gut health. It's about total body wellness. So, for example, I talked about cleaning your cookware of toxic materials, such as the nonstick surfaces, like we know the PFOA. These types of toxins are what we call POPs, persistent organic pollutants. So they enter your body and they're very, they have a high affinity to your fat. And anything that's going to have a high affinity to fat is going to stay in your body for a very long time until the body has a way to exit that. Something that's water soluble is going to have a much easier time and getting out of the body because you can pee it out. And a great example of that is that if you're taking a pharmaceutical drug, you have to take it every day because by the next day, your body has metabolized and eliminated it out of your system. Now, it doesn't. Every drug has a different half-life. But talking about these toxins, they interrupt with your metabolism. They can do things like short-circuit your mitochondria, which are the energy centers inside our cells. That's what produces the currency by which we live, which is called ATP. And they go in there and they can actually disrupt the function of the mitochondria. So you may not know that you're toxic, but what you're going to feel is that you have no energy, that you're fatigued. And perhaps you go to the doctor and they tell you your thyroid is normal, but you're still fatigued. And no one can figure it out. Well, then you have to think, are you toxic? Are you drinking out of plastic water bottles? And being exposed to what we call an endocrine disrupting chemical, like the BPA in plastics or all the different types of plasticides.
It's a really important and fascinating topic, and it's actually something I think we need to think more about, and then I'll do more programming on here on Connect the Dots, which is we've talked a lot about the adverse toxins in our environment, but you know, the specific knowledge of the health effects, I think, is a very important additional piece of all this. So maybe that'll be your next book. Actually, Vince, I can't think of anyone better to focus on that kind of subject. But in any case, we have to kind of wrap up today's show. Let's just go out, listeners, with a reminder. If you've enjoyed today's health conversation, this is Happy Gut is Vincent Pedri's first film. It just went on sale in the last several days, and it's a wonderful read. As I've mentioned, it's a terrific program because 28 days, you know, may sound like a long time to try something new, but actually accomplishing what this program does in that amount of time is really pretty awesome. So I want to thank you for being with us today. It's just been great having you on the show. And I want to wish you great luck with the book. Yeah. It's like one of our conversations at all the gatherings and parties that we attended.
I know.
You know, you'll have to come back again, and, you know, best of luck with the book, and, you know, look for it, readers. It's climbing on the book-selling lists as we speak, and for good reason. So, you know, thank you for listening, everyone, to this week's Connect the Dots. Come back next week at 10 a.m. Wednesday Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Everyone, this is our first show of the new year. Have a wonderful new year, a healthy one, a joyful one, in a world of peace and engagement and activism, moving toward health, a safe environment, social justice, and the right kinds of values in our society. Be well.